before the court that the seat next to me, generally occupied, as you all know, by Justice Steinmetz, is vacant. Justice Steinmetz is recuperating from an operation, but he is with us anyway, not only in spirit, but via the wires. At his place is a telephone conferencing equipment, and so he periodically I will talk to the box and say, "Can you hear me, Don? Can you hear me, Don?"
"I can hear you."
Okay, and that's he responding, and you may or may not hear him well enough because the acoustics in this room is poor. So if Don has a question, I will repeat it to the extent you can't hear it. And so with that announcement, so that you know the presence of Justice Steinmetz, we will proceed with 97-0466, Burks versus St. Joseph's Hospital. Linda, is it Meager?
Maher.
Meyer. Go ahead.
Thank you. Counsel for
Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Linda Maher, and I represent the defendant, respondent, petitioner of the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund. The issue in this case is very simple, and that is whether or not the fund is required to provide coverage for EMTALA claims. It's undisputed in this case that there is no medical malpractice claim. It is also undisputed in this case that medical malpractice claims are different than EMTALA claims. They're totally, entirely separate animals. The EMTALA is a federal legislation, a strict liability legislation, which requires a plaintiff only to establish whatever the prescribed conduct is in the statute. As long as that's been established, they don't have to establish standard of care or any negligence. And in a medical malpractice case, the plaintiff has got to prove negligence, a standard of care violation, that the healthcare provider breached that degree of care skill that an average healthcare provider would provide under the same or similar circumstances. Both have totally separate goals, and if we're looking at what created the fund's creation was Chapter 655. And this court has repeatedly said that Chapter 655 is limited to medical malpractice cases. And why is that? Well, that's because Chapter 655 consistently says that it is limited to medical malpractice cases. The statute that creates Chapter 655, 655-007, says that it's a exclusive process or procedure for processing malpractice claims, and the statute that creates the fund, section 655-27, says the fund provides coverage only for medical malpractice claims.
I have to tell you now.
Yes.
The sound is not coming through intelligently.
Okay, I'm sorry, Don. Just hold. Justice Steinman says he is not really able to hear. We've done this before, and we've done it successfully when Justice Geske was out after an operation. So if you'd give us a moment, this will not count against your time, counsel. Okay, we'll proceed. Don, we're trying to make repairs, and we will proceed, okay?
It comes through as sound, but not words.
Oh, okay. It's a slight problem. But it's a technical one. Technical, not substantive. Go ahead.
Lawyers are good singers. I'm not going to say much.
Okay, counsel, if you say your name again.
Sure, Linda Maher.
How's that, Don?
There was an interruption right when he said it.
I try it again.
Linda Maher.
I can't get that. It just doesn't come through as a word.
Okay. We're going to fool for another couple of seconds, and the marshal will continue doing that. And we're going to proceed because then we'll have to ask you to listen to the tapes. Okay, Don? Is that all right? But hang on, please. Right. You can hear me, I gather. Can you hear me, Don? Okay, you can hear me, he said. I'm not going to repeat your argument, counsel.
And you won't ask me to do that either.
And I won't ask you, we'd have to do it by tape. Sorry, because it didn't work before, so something's just going to rhyme. If you'd proceed, counsel.
Okay, thank you. ENTLA is a strict liability legislation, and its goal is to do two things. First, make sure that hospitals screen their patients uniformly, fairly, so that, for example, if a man comes in with chest pains, he should expect to get the same screening than any other patient that came in with chest pains, regardless of whether he has insurance or is indigent. He's supposed to get the same uniform screening. That's the first goal of EMTALA. The other goal is to make sure that patients are not transferred before they're stabilized. These goals are different than the goals of medical malpractice. The tort claim of medical malpractice is to compensate victims who were not treated appropriately due to medical negligence.
Well, counsel, let me interrupt for just a moment. St. Joseph's is a Medicare hospital, so they're covered. But let's take a hospital that is not covered under Medicare, so they are not, I take it, that hospital that is not bound under EMTALA.
Correct. That okay. is correct.
Let's assume that that hospital, let's call it St. Stan's. St. Stan's transfers a patient before that patient is stabilized. And as a result, there is injury done to the patient. Is that a medical malpractice claim?
I hate to say it, I need more facts. I mean, it would depend on what's going on with the patient. If the doctor felt that he had given this patient everything that was necessary and then transferred the patient.
Well, okay, let's assume that negligence was proven.
Okay.
Is that a medical malpractice?
Well,
that in fact he was that patient was transferred before he was stabilized.
Then it's malpractice. You have to have someone, an expert, that would say that that doctor breached the standard of care in his treatment.
But under EMTALA, I take it, you have to prove that, at least under the second condition, that the patient was transferred before the medical condition had been stabilized.
That's right.
And in a medical malpractice case, you would have to prove that the patient had been transferred before his condition had been stabilized, negligently.
Well, it depends on the case. I think that you can come up with a scenario in which the patient wasn't stabilized, yet there was no malpractice. Let me give you I was thinking of an example of this. Say a patient comes to St. Stan's in active labor, and the only person, and St. Stan's doesn't deliver babies, but this woman shows up at the emergency room. And the only person there is a resident. The resident realizes this patient needs a cesarean section, but I can't perform one as a resident. So I'm going to transfer this patient over to St. Joseph's Hospital. But the patient's not stabilized, and it's not stabilized enough to get over to St. Joseph's Hospital. I don't think anybody would criticize the resident under medical practice, but the hospital might be criticized for not stabilizing the patient. Under your scenario, though, the hospital wasn't even covered by EMTALA. So, but if the hospital were covered by EMTALA, it may be criticized for not taking whatever steps were necessary to make sure that patient was stabilized to get over to the other hospital.
Sounds to me like it's the same.
It requires different proofs, though. I mean, in terms of EMTALA, you just have to prove you violated the statute. There was a medical probability that if you let that patient out the door, that patient was going to deteriorate. That's what you have to prove. Under medical negligence, you have to prove, did that doctor exercise that degree of care and skill that an average practitioner would have exercised under the same or similar circumstances?
I agree with you. It's hard to come up with a scenario, but there are times where that may be the case. This case obviously is an example of that. I don't think any doctor would say that it's right to resuscitate a baby that's born this premature. And so that's why the plaintiffs don't have a malpractice case here, because it's not medical negligent to say, we're not going to resuscitate that. That's not ethically right. That's not medically right. And so the doctors and the hospital did not commit malpractice by not doing that. Then the issue becomes, should they have stabilized this child? Should they have done whatever it took for resuscitation to get the child to a stabilized condition so the child's on a ventilator? That's an issue that I guess has not been decided factually in this case, but St. Joseph's Hospital filed a motion to dismiss that claim, and it was denied. So this is a case where you've got a clear factual case where there's no evidence of malpractice, so you can't bring a malpractice claim. But potentially, you have a problem with a stabilization. Now, factually, are they ever going to be able to prove that? I don't know, but it's there.
I have two questions for just 1 minute. Don, is this any better? Don?
Yeah.
Is it any better? Okay. Do you want to stay on the line? He's going to stay on the line. He's not getting incomplete, but you are getting it. We are on tape. I turned up my microphone, too, to see if we can do that. Justice Crooks.
The question, Ms. Maher, I had for you relates to whether or not there was any treatment, any health care services provided to the child.
In this case?
Yes.
I do not believe so. I think the baby was born, and given the birth weight and the gestational age, there was no treatment other than comforting and giving the baby to the mother to hold, and that was, my understanding is that was the treatment given.
When you look at the administrative code 17.35.2a, and there it talks in terms of failing to provide health care services to a patient. How do you distinguish that language and say that language was not violated?
Well, I think this section goes back to Chapter 655 and 655.23 that uses the term medical malpractice. So that this section is based on that language. So it's not broader than 655.23. The other thing I would point out is if you look at the, for example, the McAvoy case, in that case, the court found that it was bad faith and not malpractice. Yet, really, the HMO was a healthcare provider. And the HMO was not providing treatment that this patient allegedly needed. So it could be malpractice, or it could fall into this very broad language, which is coverage for providing or failing to provide healthcare services. So if we're going to make it that broad, then the McAvoy case would fall into this broad language. But the court held that Chapter 655 applies only to malpractice. It doesn't apply to bad faith claims.
Well, let me approach this another way. Basically, you don't have any definition of medical malpractice in Chapter 655. So can it not be rather persuasively argued that 17.35.2a is an attempt to define medical malpractice? In other words, that the administrative code is fleshing out Chapter 655.
I would agree with you if it said medical malpractice in Chapter 655 means this, but what the code is talking about is what is required for primary liability insurance coverage. It's not talking, and it also relates back to Chapter 655, Section 2.3 that says malpractice. And it doesn't talk about what fund coverage is. It doesn't say this is what malpractice means because it's not defined in the statute, so let me define it for you. I would agree. The insurance commissioner said, you know, it's not defined in the statute, and this is what it means. that would be different. But I don't believe that that's the purpose of Section 1735. I believe it relates to what's required for primary coverage under medical malpractice claims.
Let me just follow up on Justice Crooks' question, because there basically, I know St. Joseph's seems to make your opponent seems to make a public policy argument that if you look at 655, you say, well, it's really not clear, and this is what I think Justice Crooks is talking about, that the policy or the public policy here is that the idea of your fund is to cover or is to provide for the excess coverage. And in areas like this where it is not that clear, isn't that the way to go? That's what that's one of their arguments. What's your response to just basically what is the comp fund intended for and why wouldn't it cover this type of excess situation?
Well, I think that the statute doesn't lead to some confusion for our hospital.
You say it's not ambiguous. You say it's clear. I understand.
I think the statute's clear. It says medical malpractice, and in Wisconsin, medical malpractice has a certain basic tort law to it, as the clerk understood in McAvoy, that it's a negligence claim, that you have to prove certain factors. And so I don't think anyone misled the hospital to believe that it was going to be something other than malpractice. And the other thing is, Chapter 655 nowhere says, and we're also going to provide coverage for federal legislation violations that the U.S. Congress creates.
Now, what are you then limiting medical malpractice to? Negligence, common law negligence claims?
Yes, I think if you had a contract claim with your doctor, that would be malpractice as well. I think the law has developed so that contracts with your doctor, if the doctor somehow violated a contract.
Contract of care, not payment of fees.
Correct. Right.
It would include negligence per se.
If there's a statute that would apply, not in this case, but I suppose in a case of negligent, the sex exploitation cases where there's a statute and, the doctor.
You say this was a state statute. Could you argue that it was negligence per se if there was a violation of this state statute?
I'm only hesitating because I'm trying to. So if you're saying it's a state statute that says this is malpractice, this is what you have to prove to establish malpractice, then it's negligence per se.
Well, I'm saying if this was not a federal statute but a state statute, and I don't know that it makes any difference if it's federal or state. I'm sort of just pushing you along because my next question is going to be, if I understood this, that this is a strict liability statute. Well, strict liability comes under torts, as does malpractice. And so why wouldn't you say that negligence includes strict liability? I mean, it grows out of it. I mean, one of the points about strict liability, at least strict products liability, is that it's too tough to prove negligence. The burden, in effect, shifts, and what you have is an unreasonable product that's defective. So I'm going to sort of just push you around in arguing in terms of that why isn't your definition of malpractice just too narrow in terms of common law negligence? From there, I could go to negligence per se. I can go to strict products liability, and then from there go to strict liability. And you have lots of torts cases that deal with strict liability, right? Can't think of one at the moment, but I will as it goes on, and that's usually under a doctrine of torts.
The one example I can think of, I guess, when I was looking at this is like a dog bite type case where you have, in that case, it's prescribed what the conduct is, and if you own a dog and it causes property damage or it causes personal injury, you are liable regardless of whether the owner knew the dog had this propensity, whether the dog was bad. So it's different than regular medical malpractice negligence actions. But what I would also point out is that there isn't a Wisconsin law, but if there were, I think the Reinick case makes it very clear that the Chapter 665 is supposed to be an exclusive procedure for malpractice claims. And in order for another statute to come in to that and to be used with the malpractice, the legislature has to incorporate it. And unless the legislature incorporated this statute you're talking about into Chapter 665, I would be arguing the same thing.
Okay, so you're holding to this is negligence. Medical malpractice is limited to negligence. So if there was a state statute that said, yeah, how to keep the woman who's had a baby in for 2 days, regardless of what insurance says, blah, 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 because that's what the legislature thinks is correct medical treatment, that if the hospital released the person in 1 day and it turned out to be a problem, you'd say you tested under medical, under negligence, not under the statute.
Right. It could be both. It could be, under your scenario, you could have violated the one and violated the other. But the point is that the court has ruled, and the statute says specifically, this only applies to medical malpractice. And if the Wisconsin legislature said, and by the way, we're going to process your statute, the one you're talking about, the negligent per se statute, with this malpractice claim statute, then I would agree with you.
But if they didn't, then there'd be two causes of action, and the fund would only be liable on the negligence part, not on violation of statute. That's your argument.
That's right.
Could I ask a question here? You have hospitals that are not Medicare certified in the state, and they're members of the fund, are they not?
Yes.
What is there any consequence to a young woman coming to a hospital that's not medical certified and they didn't serve her at all? Could they just turn her away?
I would say that, for example, let's say a woman came to the emergency room and there was triage and a nurse checked this patient over, and this woman obviously is in active labor and needs to be delivered, and they are able to deliver babies, and they say, "Do you have insurance? I'm sorry, we don't treat you." I think that would probably be medical negligence as well. So there's times where they're the same, where you can prove both, but you have the ability to get an expert who's familiar with hospitals who would say that if you had a patient that came in and you were evaluating this patient, and the patient was in active labor, you had a duty to treat that patient. And a reasonable hospital under the same or similar circumstances would have treated that patient.
What would be the source of the duty?
The duty would be you had seen this patient and evaluated her and let her go without treating her when she was there.
What does a doctor have to treat? Doctor or a hospital? Have to treat anyone that walks through the door? Why is that a duty? Is it a duty only because the nurse started to look at that? Or is it a duty that from...
Is that some sort of Hill-Burton obligation that's separate from EMTALA?
I'm sorry. I didn't hear the first part.
Is there some other federal law I think would be separate from EMTALA that would require a hospital to serve?
To serve the patient other than EMTALA? I don't, not that I know.
But you said if this woman came into the hospital and somebody saw her, knew she was going into labor, said, "No, not going to serve you, you don't have insurance," turns her away, you said that would be medical malpractice.
It could be if they could prove it, sure.
If they could prove it. Let's assume they could prove it. Justice Prosser said, under what law, common law, statutory law, federal or state, is a hospital obliged to take a patient, knowing the patient needs care, why do you have to have a duty to take care of him? I mean, I wouldn't have to deliver this baby, would I? No, I'm not a physician. I would not have to do it. So what's the duty? I think that's what Justice Prosser is asking you in this situation you posed.
I think that the duty, if another healthcare provider would say that it was under the, you know, a reasonable, that degree of care, skill, and judgment required that hospital to treat that patient based on her symptoms, then it could be medical malpractice as well. But maybe not. Maybe they would say, that's fine, you can do that. You can tell them to go away and go to the hospital, nearest hospital that participates in Medicare, and then I guess there wouldn't be anything that would cover that patient.
Could I ask this? I'm trying to figure out, why was it that the hospital didn't treat the newborn?
Well, as I understand it from the hospital's position, is that given the birth weight and the gestational age of this baby, it is not ethically or medically correct to give this baby any resuscitation because there's a 0% chance of survival. That's what they would say.
So it wasn't that they were just bad people that said, get out of here. Were they making a medical judgment of some kind?
I would agree that there was, in this case, although not in every case that you're going to see an EMTALA case, is there going to be medical judgment, but I would agree in this case they chose, based on medical judgment, not to provide treatment. But they can't prove malpractice because of it.
Why not?
Because any doctor who would look at this case would say, any doctor, perinatologist, or somebody who has experience, would say this is not a baby that would survive, or that this is not a case where it's medical negligence to not provide treatment for this child.
Are you implying that a hospital would have a duty under the federal law to provide services even when it was pointless?
No, I'm not saying that the EMTALA claim here is a viable claim. In fact, I'm not sure this is the best example of a case that this is going to occur in. But the reality is that there is no malpractice claim, and the trial court denied the motion to dismiss the EMTALA claim. So we do have an EMTALA claim here. Whether the plaintiff's going to be able to prove that at trial, I don't know. But this is a case where it does exist, that there is no negligence claim, yet there is a claim that they were supposed to stabilize this baby, and I think it was based on a case by the name of Baby K, is why the trial court reached its decision. My time is up.
Excuse me, Justice Brasco.
No. You have a little bit more time, I think. Go and ask your question.
Does this tantamount to if I were dying, and there's just no hope of saving me, and the hospital could make my death less tortuous and didn't? Is there anything akin to that?
Your scenario makes sense. And again, I'm not saying that the plaintiff's claim here is ever going to be able to be established. I don't know if it will be, because what you're saying makes sense. I mean, does it make sense to stabilize this patient given the scenario? Probably not. That hasn't been decided, though, yet. But there's going to be other cases where potentially the negligence claim is gone, but we still have an EMTALA claim.
Well, isn't that this case? The negligence claims have been dismissed, as
right.
I understand it. So Justice Prosser's questions about lack of care, that's gone. So it would have to come only under the statute. And can you violate the statute if you're not negligent?
Yes.
You can violate the statute even if your care has been reasonable.
All I'm suggesting is that this case may not be the best factual case, and that I don't want the court to get hung up on the facts of this case, because we don't know if the plaintiffs are going to be able to prove this.
They have to prove exactly, aren't they, Tom?
They have to prove, in this case, that the patient needed to be stabilized, and if the patient wasn't stabilized, the medical probability was that the patient would deteriorate without the stabilization. Well, I mean, the facts, the evidence may come out that the medical probability is even with the stabilization treatment, you're going to get the same result. I don't know what the facts are going to end up in this case. But what I'm suggesting is this is not the only case, even though the facts, you know, there's some facts that kind of you question whether or not they're going to be able to prove the EMTALA claim. There'll be other cases where they can prove the EMTALA claim, but not malpractice. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Peter Mullaney. I represent St. Joseph's Hospital in this matter. There are just a couple of points that I'd like to cover today. First of all, regarding reasonable expectations. So that really is the gist of St. Joseph's position in the case. Reasonable expectations of insurance coverage, or coverage in this case, through the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund. As you know, reasonable expectation of an insured is one of the hallmarks of insurance coverage analysis. In this case, St. Joseph's Hospital purchased an underlying health care liability policy pursuant to Wisconsin statutes. St. Joseph's was required to purchase this policy as a health care provider in Wisconsin. The form of that policy was established by statute and by regulation, and the policy required coverage for providing or failing to provide health care services to patients. That's the underlying policy. There's no question that an EMTALA claim is a failure to treat case. That is, the allegation is that St. Joseph's failed to provide health care to Ms. Burke's baby. It clearly comes within the underlying policy coverage. There's no dispute about that. There is underlying policy coverage. St. Joseph's position is that, pursuant to Wisconsin law, not only were we required to purchase an underlying policy, we had to pay assessments to the fund for excess coverage. This was a package deal, so to speak. We purchased the underlying coverage by statute requiring coverage for providing or failing to provide health care services. We pay assessments to the fund. The understanding is that any claims in excess of the underlying policy will be covered by the fund. That's this case. But the fund is saying, although the EMTALA claim is covered by the underlying policy, there is no coverage by the fund because of two words in the statute that say that the fund was created to cover only medical malpractice claims. The problem with that is that, well, there are really two problems. One is that the narrow construction of the phrase medical malpractice, I think, is inconsistent with the purpose of the creation of the fund, and it's also inconsistent with Chapter 655 when read in its entirety.
Mr. Mullaney, Chapter 655 doesn't define medical malpractice. How would you define it?
Exactly, Justice Crooks, and that was my next point. It doesn't define medical malpractice, and that is a significant point in St. Joseph's favor. I would define medical malpractice, we have a couple of options. If you want an objective measure, there is the medical malpractice statute of limitations, Section 893.55. The label, the caption on the statute says medical malpractice. It then goes on to say, an action to recover damages for injury arising from any treatment or operation performed by or from any omission by a person who is a health care provider, regardless of the theory on which the action is based, shall be commenced within, etc. This is the medical malpractice statute of limitations, and the way that this statute describes medical malpractice is treatment or operation performed by or an omission by a healthcare provider. We also have a definition that Justice Bradley proposed in the McAvoy decision, 213 West 2nd, 507, that's been cited in the briefs. Justice Bradley's decision at page 530 takes a definition of malpractice from Black's Law Dictionary. And I submit that this definition is not inconsistent with an EMTALA claim. There, the case says, the term is traditionally defined as professional misconduct or unreasonable lack of skill or failure of one rendering professional services to exercise that degree of skill and learning commonly applied under all the circumstances in the community by the average, prudent, reputable member of the profession. Nothing in there about common law negligence, the negligence standard of care. I think that there is nothing inconsistent with the position St. Joseph's has taken in this case, that medical malpractice means the rendering or failure to render health care services.
But Mr. Mullaney, go ahead.
Did you finish? Is that what you, I want you to fully state your definition of medical malpractice. Is that it? Rendering or failing to render what?
Healthcare services to a patient. I believe I would prefer to use the definition, this was the last one I was going to cite, in the regulation that prescribes the required coverage for underlying policies. That's section 17.35 of the insurance code. It requires coverage for providing or failing to provide health care services to a patient and injuries that result therefrom. I mean, it's a broad definition, and I think that's what the legislature had in mind.
It is a broad definition. I have always assumed that for a medical malpractice action under 655, there always had to be a negligence component. I guess you are telling us that there does not have to be a negligence component. Is that your point?
Well, I don't know that I would put it in that phrase, because McAvoy case addressed that issue. I think the fear addressed in the McAvoy decision was that Chapter 655 might become a vehicle for alleging bad faith claims or other kinds of cases. But I think the real measure here is whether we're talking about medical judgments, errors in medical judgment. And I submit that we submit that Chapter 655 deals with errors in medical judgment, mistakes in medical judgment.
That still rings to me of negligence. Let me put it a different way. I agree with you that EMTALA is failure to treat. That, at least that's one of the objectives, to reach those cases. But it seems to me you can have a negligent failure to treat case, and you can also have a non-negligent failure to treat case. So if you were to go to my hypothetical St. Stan's that is not covered under Medicare, so that they're not bound by EMTALA, even if you, as a plaintiff, were to sue St. Stan's under Chapter 655 for failure to treat, you would have to prove negligent failure to treat, would you not?
You're talking about a case where St. Stan's is not bound by EMTALA.
Yes.
Honestly, Justice, I don't know what the law is in the absence of EMTALA. My understanding of EMTALA was that it was created because hospitals do not have a duty to treat. And that is why the federal government created the statute, to create that duty. Would they have to prove negligence? I guess so. I mean, I don't know. I don't know the answer to whether they would have a cause of action other than negligence.
See, that's
without the, EMTALA. Sorry? Without
EMTALA.
So that's the problem that I have, and where you've got to address to convince me to vote for you. And that is this, that if I am suing under medical malpractice, Chapter 655, on a failure to treat, I have to prove negligence. But if I am suing under EMTALA, I don't have to prove negligence. Isn't that correct? And if it is correct, why should it not make a difference for you to prevail?
I think it is correct. You do not have to prove negligence to prevail under EMTALA. I don't think there's any question about that. We have not disputed that.
In fact, you'd be out of luck because the negligence causes of action have been dismissed, which means you probably couldn't prove negligence.
Correct.
Please continue answering the question.
What we are saying is that EMTALA is about medical decisions. It requires proof of failure to stabilize or failure to examine. These are medical decisions made by physicians on the front lines of medical care, unlike McAvoy, where you're talking about an administrator making decisions about coverage for patients, not a treater. I don't mean to divert my attention, but I think that's significant. In McAvoy, you were talking about not a healthcare provider, but an administrator on some 15th floor office somewhere saying that this patient is going to be cut off for financial reasons. And that's why the court said, in essence, that it was not a Chapter 655 case. It wasn't medical malpractice. It was a breach of contract, a tort of bad faith. It was not medical. This case, Justice Babbage, is about medical treatment, as are all EMTALA cases. That's what the statute talks about. It talks about failing to stabilize, allowing a patient's condition to deteriorate such that their health is in danger. We're talking about suits against healthcare providers, people on the front lines, unlike McAvoy, where it's against an HMO, an administrator. These cases are about medical decisions. And the reason it comes within Chapter 655, even though it is not a negligence case in the traditional common law sense, is because it's all about medical care. It's all about failing to provide appropriate medical treatment. There's a different standard, granted, but it's about failing to provide medical care. And that is crucial because I think the statutes and the regulation, particularly the one that talks about the scope of underlying coverage, contemplates that the policy in Wisconsin is that healthcare providers have coverage for providing or failing to provide healthcare to the patients that walk in the door, and the fund is designed to cover claims in excess of those policies.
It seems to me that your argument can be boiled down to this. You accept any of these definitions, and although I would worry about McAvoy, Bradley, Black's dictionary, but if you accept the others, medical malpractice is rendering or failing to render health care services to a patient. You are saying, as I hear you, that the rendering or the failing to render can either come up through negligence, strict liability, or statutory violation. So if the statute says you must render this service, even if under the medical profession, in reasonable medical care, they would say you don't. But the statute says you do. You would say it's covered under 655. Is that right?
Covered under 655, you mean the fund would get?
Yes. Yes, because it's failure to render health care services as required by statute, even though not required under reasonable medical care.
Well, really all we're saying is that a violation of EMTALA under any circumstances is covered by the fund.
Right, so you're saying that medical... I'm trying to see if this is what you're saying.
I apologize if I'm not...
No, that's okay. That medical malpractice includes the failure to render health care services as required by a federal statute here in Tala. I mean, I think that's Justice Babbage was emphasizing, and I'm just restating your definition of medical malpractice and asking you, is that what you intend?
Yes.
I'll read it. Yeah. Failure to render health care services means negligence or failing to abide by a federal statute, even if the federal statute requires health care that is not required by reasonable physicians using their own judgment.
In other words, negligence is not a necessary component of 655 for the fund to be liable for overage.
Well,
that's why I think this is
my only concern about that is that if I agree to that, then maybe that appears in a decision, and lawyers can read that to say that Chapter 655
covers bad faith.
Covers a lot of stuff, and I don't think that that's the point we're trying to make.
That's why I stated including a violation of the federal statute that relates to health care to a patient.
I think that's fair. I mean, I think that what we want to focus on in this case is I think the court can issue a decision that is consistent with every other decision this court has ever issued and Chapter 655 if it rules that Chapter 655 covers common law medical malpractice, negligence cases, and EMTALA claims, because EMTALA claims are all about failure to treat, failure to provide medical care to patients, and that is consistent with the underlying policy requirements.
It's the same way I said it. You just put in EMTALA first because that's failure to render health care. I said failure to render health care, including EMTALA, because that relates to health care to a physician, to a patient. So you want it limited to health care to a patient, violating either the medical care doctrine or a statute that relates to medical care directly to a patient.
Yes, I think that's fair.
So it's a strict liability.
Can I ask a question? The mother arrives at St. Joseph's, the baby is born, and a decision is made not to treat that baby any further.
I'm sorry?
After the baby is born, a decision is made not to treat the baby any further. I don't want to know individual names, but was the decision not to treat made by a doctor?
Yes.
Was that doctor following any guidelines from the hospital?
Yes, Justice Prosser. Although I don't want to speak out of turn because that really goes to the merits of the EMTALA claim, which is a separate issue. But we did submit in the trial court an affidavit from Dr. Robb, R-A-A-B, that I cited in the brief. He's a neonatologist at St. Joseph's, I believe the chief of staff, and his affidavit establishes that it is essentially impossible to resuscitate a baby of this size, born 4 months premature. So that was the basis. I can't recall if Dr. Robb was actually on the scene, but I do know that St. Joseph's is known statewide and perhaps nationally for its neonatology unit. So this was not, as you mentioned earlier, a case of bad people. But if St. Joe's couldn't do anything for this baby, nobody could. And that's the defense on the merits in the underlying case. And that's why it's a medical decision. That's why the defense in the case on EMTALA will be primarily a medically based defense. It wasn't a coverage decision, or it wasn't coverage wasn't, or treatment wasn't denied because there was no insurance. It was treatment was not rendered because they couldn't do anything for this baby. And the record does establish that, but again, that really goes to the merits.
Explain. I have another question with respect to EMTALA itself, the second aspect, that the hospital may not transfer out of the hospital a patient whose medical condition has not been stabilized. And we've agreed now that this is a strict liability, it's a failure to treat statute. Now, What if the hospital has a defense that, in fact, although the patient's condition had not stabilized, better services could have been provided at a hospital just down the street? Is that a defense to an EMTALA claim?
Possibly.
Do we know?
We don't know a lot about EMTALA, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. The statute was passed in 1986, I believe. The case law that we canvassed when we tried to dismiss the case in the first instance in the trial court was a little inconsistent and unclear about how EMTALA should be enforced, what the defenses are. Historically, the cases that were filed, or the motions that were filed in the early cases, argued that unless the plaintiff could establish that treatment was denied solely for economic reasons, the plaintiff could not proceed. Because EMTALA was passed as a anti-patient dumping statute, the idea being that if someone walks into the emergency room with a broken leg and a ruptured pancreas and says, "I want treatment," and the hospital says, "Do you have insurance?" They say, "No." The hospital says, "See you later." That was the concern. Pardon?
See you later, baby.
Hey, well.
Do you have any cases or authority that support that proposition?
Well,
The proposition being that the patient would have to prove that it was an economic reason for dumping them.
There are cases, just established. We did cite, I believe they're in the record in this court, on our motion for summary judgment. There were cases that said, there was a split of decisions. I believe some courts say you've got to prove, it's got to be an economic decision. If it's not, if they weren't rejected because of economic reasons, it's not an EMTALA claim. And there are other courts that say, no, the statute itself doesn't really say that. It's more than there's something more to it. It's not real clear. But the trial court in this case said that the plaintiff, even though I think it's clear the treatment wasn't denied for economic reasons, that is because she didn't have insurance, that was not an issue. The trial court said they can still proceed. So I can't tell you what the defenses are in the case exactly. I think that hospitals are going to try all kinds of things. Certainly there are causation defenses about whether you're going to get experts on whether the condition would have deteriorated had treatment been provided, whether treatment would have made a difference, in other words. That's part of these cases. That's come up in the case law that we cited in the court below. That's part of our defense here. If we had provided treatment, the baby would still have died within a couple of hours of birth. So the point, though, bringing it back to the issue in this case, is that EMTALA claims, by and large, will be medically based. It'll be about failure to treat and the medical reasons for that. There will be experts talking about causation. Those issues will all be part of these cases because hospitals are sophisticated places, and I don't mean to give them too much credit, but I think that they're all aware of EMTALA, and they know they can't simply turn people away at the desk because they don't have insurance. They've got to treat, and the cases, by and large, will arise because the hospitals do treat, but the patients say they didn't treat aggressively enough. They didn't give the most sophisticated treatment that they could have for economic reasons or otherwise. They should have called in consultants. They should have done all kinds of things that are really medically based. And our position is that these kinds of cases, EMTALA claims, are going to be very similar to Chapter 655 malpractice claims. They fall within the ambit of what the legislature had in mind when it created a system for making sure that victims of malpractice had access to coverage through hospitals and healthcare providers, and that the fund would provide excess coverage.
Do we have to answer the question that I posed in this case? Well, let's say that we decide that a certain type of EMTALA claim I mean, right now I'm bothered about, you know, first of all, I thought, well, are there any EMTALA claims recovered? Now I'm thinking, well, maybe those EMTALA claims that do not, that don't prove something other than economic patient dumping, but rather, what if the EMTALA claim does prove that the hospital transferred, even though the condition hadn't stabilized, because there was better facilities somewhere else? You know, do we have to decide that issue in this case? Or is that something you're going to crack out below if we go back?
Well, I think that this court could rule that EMTALA claims, all EMTALA claims, are covered by the fund. And the reason is that the nature of the allegations that must be pled in the complaint are medical. Maybe the decision was economic, but by the statutory language, they're going to have to plead that the hospital failed to stabilize, medically stabilize a condition, that they failed to examine a patient. I think that the allegations in these EMTALA claims are, in any case, regardless of what the defenses are or the actual proof is, in any case, they're going to be the kinds of claims that the legislature intended to come within Chapter 655. Because they're essentially failure to treat, failure to provide medical care.
For any reason.
Our
reason is irrelevant. Failure to provide medical care.
Counsel, does this work at all? I'm kind of following up on Justice Babbage's hypothetical. Let's say the state of the law in Wisconsin, and I think that it is that there's no clear-cut duty to refer. Arguably, that's the state of the law. Let's say there's a statute that says only Class 1 hospitals can perform this type of risky operation. And you have a doctor in a Class 2 hospital who's competent to do it, who would arguably certainly have the requisite standard of care, but then there's the statutory duty. So under that scenario, there could be, arguably, a cause of action for a violation of the statutory duty to refer for medical treatment. But there would be no cause of action for medical negligence. Is that correct? Is that at all analogous to what you have here? A statutory duty, no common law negligence duty. There's no common law negligence duty that would be violated that would form the basis of a medical malpractice action. But there's a statutory duty in my hypothetical, it was a statutory duty to refer, because I think perhaps the state of the law in Wisconsin is not settled. That Johnson case kind of said it wasn't settled as to whether or not there's a duty to refer, in the world of negligence, whether or not there's a duty to refer for further treatment or explanation. It was the context of informed consent, I think. But you could have a statute that would require referral, even though there wouldn't be any traditional medical negligence involved. You're not biting on that, so that's not it.
Well, I guess I would agree that there are cases, and I don't know if this is what you're getting at, but there are cases that where there is no negligence claim, but there would be an EMTALA claim. Is that what you're talking about?
The duty of a statutory violation, even though there's no conceivable violation of a common law duty of due care.
Okay, well, I think that there would be, I'm not sure what situation you're talking about. I mean, this case is one where there is no negligence claim, but there is an EMTALA violation, and I guess I'm not tracking exactly what the difference is between your hypothetical and this case, but in any event, if we're talking about your hypothetical, a potential violation of EMTALA for doctor's failure to transfer, we still think that that's the kind of case, the kind of claim that would fall within Chapter 655 and fund coverage.
Now, how is medical malpractice defined in the jury instructions? I didn't just check.
I don't have the instruction with me.
I can look. Would you satisfy that?
Pardon?
Would an emetolic claim satisfy it?
The jury instruction? I don't know. I haven't. I don't think it was part of the briefing in the case. Okay. But
I've got a copy. Go ahead. Justice Prosser has the question.
I'm a little bit unclear still what your position is. Is every single violation of EMTALA subject to the patient's compensation fund, irrespective of motivation?
I think so. It's difficult to conceive or think right now of all the potential possibilities here, but I think that if you look at the statutory language, what constitutes an EMTALA claim, it does contemplate some kind of medical judgment, medical decision, at least the allegations do. So, yeah, I do think that every EMTALA claim would be covered by the fund as the system is currently arranged, because for no other reason based on what I've already said, it certainly is covered under healthcare liability policies, the primary coverage. I mean, it is a failure to render medical treatment for whatever reason. If you look at Regulation 17.35, that says that's healthcare liability. That's covered under healthcare liability. EMTALA claims are covered under the primary healthcare liability policy. And for the same reason, based on the reasonable expectations of the parties, we're saying that the fund should cover all of these claims, all of EMTALA claims, for the same reason. They're all failure to treat cases, all failure to render health care, no matter what the reason.
Counsel Justice Babbitt has a question.
Well, counsel, grinding all of this down and coming out one end of the chute, it seems to me that your position, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems to me that your position is that the fund